Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is podcast number 121 for March 21st, 2012. That's Wednesday, March 21st, 2012. And my name is Ben Stone. I think on the last podcast I forgot to introduce myself. Very sorry. Now, I wanted to cover some things. A friend of mine referred me to a YouTube video by a gentleman named Gary Fielder. So I went over to take a look at it, and oh my, it's an hour and a half video. And I thought, okay, well, I'll give it a shot. I really have better things to do than to watch an hour and a half video on the Federal Reserve. But I'll try. And so I went over and I tried to watch this thing. Now, I'm not going to put a link to it because right now, as of the recording of this, the video doesn't have a lot of viewership, and I really don't want to encourage anybody else to watch the thing. First off, I'm not sure I would really have to be in love with a video to recommend an hour and a half YouTube video to anybody. But anyway, but I gave it a shot. The name of the video is called The Jig Is Up, The Federal Reserve and You. And in the notes below it, it says populist lawyer Larry Fielder. Now, populist lawyer, well, that's an interesting terminology. Let's just take a real quick look at Wikipedia here. Back when Sarah Palin first appeared out of nowhere on the political scene, I referred to her as being a populist, and there was some confusion. A lot of people kind of questioned calling her a populist. And some people thought she was libertarian, and some people thought she was conservative, and some people thought she was a right-wing nutcase. But I referred to Sarah Palin as a populist, and the reason why is very similar to the definition here that Wikipedia gives of the populist movement. This is Wikipedia's first part of their little deal here on the word populism. Populism can be defined as an ideology or a political philosophy or type of discourse. Generally, a common theme compares the people against the elite and urges social and political system changes. It can also be defined as a rhetorical style employed by members of various political or social movements. It is defined by the Cambridge Dictionary as political ideas and activities that are intended to represent ordinary people's needs and wishes. It can be understood as any political discourse that appeals to the general mass of the population, to the people as such, regardless of class distinctions and political partisanship. A folksy appeal to the average guy, or some allegedly general will. Now, the reason I'm bringing that up, you know, this guy calls himself a populist lawyer. And the interesting aspect of populism, and this is why I threw it at Sarah Palin back, what is that, almost 8 years ago? Yeah, it's been 8 years ago. No, I'm sorry, 4 years ago. We've only suffered Obama for 4 years. But anyway, the reason I threw that label at Sarah Palin 4 years ago is because she was coming out and she was really rallying the troops and really getting people behind her, and she wasn't saying anything. And that's what you see a lot of times from populist leaders or from populist people who refer to themselves as populist. They have a lot to say, but there's really not any substance in it. So when I saw that, when I saw the subheading on this, the subheading would be the Federal Reserve and You. So this is in the notes below the YouTube video where it calls this Gary Fielder a populist lawyer. I thought, oh, great. Okay, so then I started to watch this. Like I said, an hour and a half video. Man. So I started watching it. Now, here's one thing about it. It didn't do, I was afraid to begin with. I was afraid to begin with that it was just another greenbacker propaganda piece. And I really didn't want to sit through an hour and a half of greenbacker nonsense again. So I kind of decided to myself, all right, well, as soon as they start flooding me with lies, I'll make note of a couple of the lies, and then that's it. Because I don't want to sit and just listen to the same regurgitated nonsense over and over in the same made-up greenbacker history that they cling to. So I started watching this thing, and I was kind of amazed that within the first few minutes of the video, they hadn't lied. They hadn't blatantly just thrown out a bunch of misinformation and lies like the typical greenback videos do. You know, the The Secret of Oz and some of these other greenbacker videos, just in some of the zeitgeist stuff, just immediately start barfing lies right in your face. And just like, you know, anyway, okay. So I'll critique this film, not the others. So I started watching this. The jig is up. The jig is up. The Federal Reserve and You by Gary Fielder. And one of the first things I noticed is as he's trying to explain the difference between fiat money and real money. He kind of gives the kind of a translation, you know, like, let me put it this way. Let's say I was going to describe a car to you. I was going to tell you what you say you're from a foreign land. You don't have any idea what I'm talking about. A car. So I'm going to try to describe a car to you. And I could say things like, well, it has four wheels and you sit inside of it and it has a glass windshield, or in the UK, they call it a windscreen. And it has a radio that you can turn the dials on, and it has adjustable seats that you can sit in and move around until you're comfortable. And all these things are true. I'm not saying anything that's not true about the car, but I'm not providing the critical piece of evidence or the critical piece of information that allows you to actually understand what a car is. It's an object that is self-mobile, that will move you from one place, you and the things that you put inside this car. It will move you from one place to another using energy other than your own physical body. It has its own engine or motor of some kind that will move it along. But that would be the critical piece of information to distinguish what a car is. It's an object that allows you to move around without using your own physical strength, see? And I could give all kinds of descriptions of a car and leave out that critical part, and you would still not know what a car is. And that's kind of what this guy does with trying to describe fiat money. He talks around in circles, and he doesn't actually say anything wrong, but he leaves out one critical aspect of what the word fiat means. Fiat is not just issued by an emperor or issued by the state. Fiat literally means that you take it in faith. You accept it in faith. It is faith-based. That's what fiat is. When you use the word fiat, I've said this before, it's very similar to how we would say the word amen at the end of a prayer. It's to say, so be it, or as it is, or so it is. So it's an act of faith. So when the government says this money is worth $1, or when the government says this money is worth whatever, or when the government issues this money, we believe in faith that it has value. Therefore, we act upon that faith. And that's the essence of what fiat money is. It is money that is faith-based money. As long as people believe in it, it functions perfectly. But as people lose faith in it, it begins to lose value. And when the moment comes that people lose faith in it entirely, it loses all value. As fiat money always has throughout history, it always comes to that point at some time. So it's a little worrisome as you're starting to watch this video that he can't actually define that. And then he goes on to talk about real money, and he fails to talk about You know, any kind of commodity money doesn't have to be silver and gold. This is something greenbackers always like to do. They always like to distract the topic by talking about silver and gold. And commodity-based money doesn't have to be silver and gold, and you don't have to actually hold the coins in your hand. You can have a variety of different representations, and they can represent a variety of different commodities. But the greenbackers like to only talk about the part of the discussion that they want to talk about. That's one of the real aspects of greenbackers, that if you really watch for that in the conversation, it's real easy to spot a greenbacker early in the conversation, even if he's trying to hide himself. And most smart greenbackers do try to hide what they're really trying to portray, because if they came right out and said it, it sounds so ridiculous that you would just reject it right off. It's kind of like any other sales technique where someone's trying to sell you something you don't really need. If they just come right out and tell it to you and you recognize you don't need that thing, then you're not going to buy it. But if they go through a long process of instilling into your mind how desperately you need this thing, then they have a better chance of selling their hoax to you. And that's what the concept of the greenback dollar is. It's a hoax. It's a scam. That's all it is. Okay, so let me get back to this thing. So he starts talking, and he can't really give a good explanation of what fiat money is. He misses the whole point of it being faith-based. And then he goes on and he talks about banking. Now, here again, the same technique is used in this video that with regards to banking that he used with fiat. He explains banking as if all banking is fractional reserve. Now, that's not the case. Even in the 1800s, today, in, 2012, the vast majority of what's accepted as banking is a fractional reserve banking. There are non-legitimate banks that are real, that are legitimate banking, but the vast majority of banking as we know it today in 2012 is fractional reserve banking. But throughout history, most of the time, fractional reserve banking was called robbery or was called fraud or theft, because in many cases, fractional reserve banking was against the law because it's so obviously a fraud. But and then that's really what came about as a change in the 1800s, is this con that fractional reserve banking could actually work. So anyway, by eliminating discussion of legitimate banking and only discussing fractional reserve banking, acting like that's the only banking that exists, you take part of the conversation away, and you only allow in your sales pitch, you're only allowing the part of the conversation that you want to deal with into the discussion. And therefore, you have already halfway won the conversation. If let me think of a way that I could explain this. Let's go back to the car thing. Let's say you're thinking of buying a car. So you go to the car dealer, and let's say the car dealer that you're going to sells brand new Chryslers, and he also sells brand new Honda cars, and that's the only types of cars that he sells. So you show up at the car dealer and you're looking at the Hondas and you're looking at the Chryslers and you're thinking, this might be good or that might be good. And then you're wondering in your mind, I wonder what Ford has in this price range, or I wonder what Chevrolet has in this price range, or I wonder what Hyundai has. And so the salesman starts to talk to you, and in the course of his discussion, he omits all information about Fords and Chevys and Hyundais and sort of almost pretends as though they don't exist, almost pretends as though the only cars that are available are Chryslers and Hondas. You see, by doing that, he's eliminated the competition without actually putting them side by side and letting them compete. And that's kind of what the greenbacker often does in these conversations. And that's what this guy does as well. get to my notes here. Gary Fielder. That's what he does with the discussion of banking. He presents banking as though the only banking is fractional reserve banking. And this is one of the things that you're always going to see with greenbackers, is the twisting of information in regards to debt and loans and borrowing money. They have this obsession, this almost unnatural hate of all things debt. Now, I think people should do everything they can to get out of debt, and I think that debt is very dangerous. Debt is wider. To borrow money has to do with time preference. It doesn't necessarily, it can be a scam. It can be a way to get into debt slavery, as they like to call it, but it doesn't have to be. You can have legitimate borrowing of money, and you can have legitimate banking where money is loaned, and not have fractional reserve banking, which is a scam, which is fraud. Now, for instance, the greenbacker will always jump to the conversation about how whenever money is loaned, it's money is created. Well, with fractional reserve banking, yes. With honest banking, no. So again, what they're doing here is they're leaving out part of the conversation in order to guide your mind only towards the product that they're selling you, only towards the greenbacker concept that they're selling. If we allow in the concept of honest banking and honest debt management by an honest bank, then it just blows their whole greenback argument away. So they don't want to talk about honest banking. At this point, it might be better if some of these greenbackers who are actually honest and yet deceived, people who think greenbacking might be a good idea for the monetary system, but are not the salesmen of this thing, it might be better if they would just maybe try to get a grasp of some of the Rothbardian concepts on this topic. To Mises, the concept of money and banking, it might be a little thick to try to jump into. And the Rothbard book that I'm trying to think of doesn't pop into my head at the moment, but maybe if I remember to do this, maybe I'll put a link to the Rothbard book that I'm thinking about in the notes for today. Now, I should apologize. Oh, I should have started this off with an explanation yet again of what the greenbacker idea is, or what being a greenbacker actually is. So let me do that real quick. The greenbacker concept, this originates with Lincoln worshippers to begin with. But typically your greenbacker will be a Lincoln worshipper, not always, but they usually idolize Lincoln at some point during their sermons. But the greenbacker concept, or the greenbacker idea of money, is basically that you would have the U.S. Congress, or whichever country, perhaps a parliament in some other country or whatever, would be in complete control of the money supply, and all money would be issued by, in the case of the U.S., by Congress. Congress would issue its own fiat money backed by nothing other than supposedly the good faith in Congress. Now, in the greenbacker's mind, this would allow Congress to issue all the money it needed in order to pay all the bills that the government needed to pay. And the greenbacker generally will go far enough to say that you need some kind of constitutional amendment or some kind of constitutional restrictions to keep Congress from just, printing money unlimited and completely wiping out the value of the money. And so that's basically the greenback story. They want all money to be issued by the government, and they want restrictions put on the government as to how much money that the government can create at any particular time. Now, in doing this, their idea is that you can now eliminate either all or most taxes, because whatever money that the government needs to function, they can just print it up. This relies on a few fallacies. First off, the ludicrous point of view that Congress could be limited by a simple notations on a piece of paper. Now, all I know, we have to worship the Constitution. We have to bow before the Holy Constitution because it's so good at controlling government, right? Like in the 240 years of the Constitution, it's done such a bang-up job of controlling government, even though it was violated repeatedly in every single administration since it was signed, even though it's pretty much been ignored by every single Congress that's been elected into office, and certainly by every president. Somehow we're supposed to have faith that writing on this piece of paper is going to limit Congress, and that they're not just going to willy-nilly just start printing all the money that they want and doing everything that they want to do in a completely unlimited fashion. You know, according to that same Constitution, the Congress is supposed to have limitations on their budget, and they're supposed to not reauthorize the Army to be funded except in times of war, national emergency, for more than a set period of time. And yet, they just continually do that. And why? Because we have the excuse. There's always an emergency. It's always an emergency. It always has been. It always will be. In other words, the limit that the Constitution specifically put on Congress to keep it from having a standing army failed to keep it from having a standing army from within the first administration. And it has failed in every administration since then. Oh, what about the Second Amendment? Oh, we have the Second Amendment to protect our gun rights, right? Well, you know, if you listen to my podcast, you know what I think about gun rights. You don't have a right to a gun any more than you have a right to bubble gum or hairspray. You don't have a right to objects. You have a right to property. And the property doesn't matter if it's a pistol or a rifle or bubble gum or a bazooka or an armed tank or an aircraft carrier. You have a right to property. If it's your property and you own it rightfully, then no one has the right to take it away from you. You don't have a right to a gun. You have a right to anything you might own rightfully. And yet, this holy Second Amendment that so many people bow before does nothing to keep the government from restricting what kind of gun you have, or how many you have, or what kind of ammunition you have, or where you store it, or how you carry it, or how you move it around from place to place. And yet that holy Second Amendment that everybody bows before says right in it, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. I focused on that before, infringed. Infringed comes, fringe is that little part right around the base of a piece of cloth. It's the very edge of it, the fringe. To infringe on my property means to put your little toe on my property. It doesn't mean to just walk right off into the middle of it. You infringe my right to keep and bear arms when you tell me how long of a knife I can carry. You infringe upon my right to keep and bear arms when you tell me I have to have a permission slip to carry a weapon. The Second Amendment means nothing. It's been infringed, and nobody's doing a thing about it. The Constitution no more limits Congress on money production than it does on gun rights, on your supposed gun rights. If it can't understand that simple phrase, infringe, the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. If they trample that and nobody can do a thing about it, and don't tell me, oh, well, they're changing that. No, it's not changing. I can't just walk into a Walmart and buy a machine gun or a bazooka or a hand grenade, can I? Then it's infringed, isn't it? Now, the same goes for Congress with printing money. You think they spend now? Give them the opportunity to print money and watch them spend. Now, here's the other thing the greenbacker will do. They will always come to the point of saying, well, you know, they divert the argument by trying to put you, when you try to point these things out, that Congress can't control their spending. Congress is not going to control the amount of, if they have the right to make their own cash, they'll just make unlimited amounts. Well, then they want to take you back to, well, then you just love the Federal Reserve. No, I don't. I could say that apples are poison, and if I thoroughly believe apples are poison, that doesn't mean I believe that oranges are poison. It's or that oranges are good. The two things are not related. The Federal Reserve is basically legal robbery. The Federal Reserve is based on fractional reserve banking. I've already said that's robbery, that's fraud. So just because I say also Congress making their own money, that would be robbery as well. That doesn't mean that now I'm all of a sudden authorizing the Federal Reserve. This is a distraction that the greenbackers use in the conversation. They try to say, well, they try to make it out as though you only have these two options. You can have the Chrysler or you can have the Honda. Well, what about if I want a Ford? Oh, you just say that because you love Hondas. Wait, what? There's more than the two choices. I don't have to give all these rights to Congress to be able to, so that they can just print up money as they will, or give it to fractional reserve banks so that they can print up money as they will. There's another option. There's an option called the market. That option is to allow the market to decide what is money, what the value of that money is, and how that money is circulated. And that's the one thing the greenbacker can never allow. Now, unfortunately, in the past, the greenbacker argument never really appealed to your average run-of-the-mill libertarian, because many libertarians are already based in Austrian economics. So as soon as they start to hear the greenbacker information, they realize right away that we're talking about socialism here, and we don't want anything to do with that because libertarians are opposed to socialism. So typically in the past, a greenbacker argument is never really appealed to libertarians. But in recent years, the greenbackers have begun using terminology and imagery to try to con libertarians into believing this. So there are many libertarians who are confused, and they accept some or all of these aspects of the greenbacker argument. That doesn't mean they're not libertarians. It just means they haven't thought things through and they're not consistent. If a person really thinks through the libertarian argument and then really thinks through the greenbacker argument, you'll see that when Congress controls the issuing of money, that is socialism. Now, what we have currently is that Congress, that the government has an arrangement with a private organization, which is the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve issues the money. That's fascism. When you have this marriage between corporations and government, and the two work together to control the means of production, that's fascism. So that's what we have now with the Federal Reserve, and we've had it since 1913. We've been under a fascist government since 1913. And if we took the Federal Reserve out of the picture altogether and gave control of the money supply over to Congress, then we would have socialism. Now, this is not my definition. Again, I've said this before, go back to Marx and read Marx. So essentially, that's the greenbacker argument, that socialism, that a socialized money system would be better than the fascist money system we have now. And in their discussions of this, they choose to ignore free market arguments altogether. That way they don't have to deal with them. I'm going to break now for a commercial, and when I come back, I'll try to get back to the point of the actual video and do a little debunking on it, and we'll try to get back to the topic on that and stay away from the general bashing of the greenbackers. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to badquaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at survival gear bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help badquaker.com and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support badquaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to badquaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page. And then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value. Something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. Thanks for sticking with me through the commercial, folks. Let me give a real quick recap of where we've gone so far. Now, we're talking about a YouTube video, an hour and a half long YouTube video called The Jig Is Up, The Federal Reserve and You by Gary Felder. And I wanted to point out that, I did point out in the beginning of this podcast, that he misses the point in describing fiat money as being faith-based. And then he misses the point in describing fractional reserve banking as he pretends in the conversation that fractional reserve banking is the only type of banking. And he leaves off honest banking and makes it appear as though all debt is in the form of fractional reserve, where new money creation takes place when debt occurs. And, of course, that's not the case with honest banking. And then he goes on to refer to he does give just a very mild reference to the business cycle. But in doing so, he gives a basic Keynesian explanation of the business cycle. Now, so just in the beginning of this video, you get the understanding, or you get the impression, that he has either chosen to ignore or he has no concept of the Rothbardian position in the difference between fractional reserve banking and honest banking. And he has no understanding at all, or apparently has no understanding, of the Austrian explanation for the business cycle. If he does know these arguments, then he intentionally ignores them. But I have a tendency to think he probably has never even heard the arguments, because most of these greenbackers, they get sold this bill of goods and they just jump onto it, and they never really bother to go back and see what the real problem with it is. When they do, then, you know, logic demands they abandon their position. But okay, so now we have these points that he is not entirely wrong, but not right on fiat money. He is only seeing half the story on debt and on fractional reserve banking. And he completely misses the point on the business cycle. And then he starts in the history. Now, up to that point in the film, and we're talking about the first, I think about the first 20 minutes or so. And during that entire time, he never actually lies. Now, this is really unusual for a greenbacker. Normally, they begin hitting you with lies within the first couple minutes. If you take, for example, a video like The Secret of Oz, where I can't remember now, but I think within the first 15 minutes, I found something like 17 lies or something like that, at a rate of more than a lie per minute that they spew at you in the beginning of the movie, The Secret of Oz. So that's typical of greenbackers, is to just start spewing lies and then repeating those lies over and over as if they're facts, and then basing more lies back on those lies that they've already sold to you. That's the typical greenbacker argument that you get. And this guy really broke the pattern, I thought, by not beginning right off the bat with a bunch of lies. Now, sure, he gives half-truths in his description of fiat money, in his description of loaning money in fractional reserve banking. He's giving half-truths. And then in his explanation of the business cycle, sure, he gives the Keynesian version of that instead of the Austrian version, but that, you know, maybe he's not lying. Maybe he just is uneducated and doesn't know. But then around the 20 minutes or so, he starts to give his little history lesson where he starts talking about the colonies and what happened in between the 16 and mid 1700s. And now we get into, you know, lies. He starts talking about honest money. Now, this is something you'll see from greenbackers love to use tricky terminology like honest money. Now, if you're talking about honest money, he refers to money issued by a governor as being honest money. I think maybe he needs to read a little bit of Rothbard to find out the difference between honest money and everything else. But so we let him slip on that. We let him slip on the idea that when the colonies were issuing fiat currency, somehow that was honest money. Even though the actual history of that time shows that every time the colonies tried to issue a bunch of fiat money, it had horrible consequences. We're just going to ignore that. And he's just going to call that honest money. What the colonies were issuing like that. And he's going to ignore the fact that there was actually real money floating around in the colonies the whole time. There was Spanish money. There was all kinds of real money based on gold and silver that was floating around. But typically these greenbackers will ignore all the history of that, and they will only focus on fiat money that the colonies were issuing. And then this is a quote that he says. He's talking about the time when right after the War of Independence. And I might mention, this is just a pet peeve, when people talk about the War of Independence and they refer to it as the Revolutionary War, there was no revolution. There has never been a revolution in, in North America? There's never been a revolution in North American recorded history, as there has never been a civil war in North American recorded history in North America. Canada has never had a civil war. Canada has never had a revolution. The United States has never had a revolution or a civil war. A civil war and or a revolution is where the government, it's an attempt to overthrow and take control of the government. Well, in our War of Independence in the mid-1700s, we did not attempt to invade England and conquer London and take control of the government. We did not do that. We attempted to separate ourselves from that government and make our own independence. That's not revolution. That's independence. And in the 1860s, when the conflict took place between the North and the South, that was not a civil war, neither was it a revolution. There were no rebels involved. No one in the South attempted to overthrow the government in Washington, D.C. That just didn't happen. Therefore, the terminology is incorrect. And this is something, and I say it's a pet peeve, but it's really important if you think about it. If you can control the language and if you can control what things are called, then you already, just by doing that, you control the direction of the conversation. So in other words, if, you know, it's the old thing, if you're talking to somebody and you say, do you still beat your wife? Well, how do you answer that? No, I don't beat my wife. Oh, then you must have stopped. Well, no, I never did. I never have. So you've already put the person on the defensive through the use of your terminology. And that's kind of the same way when you start saying things like the Civil War or the Revolutionary War. There was no revolution. We never fought England in a revolution attempting to take over their government. There have been revolutions in England, but never in North America. There's never been a revolution in North America. Well, that's not true. Mexico's part of North America. Mexico has faced revolution over and over. But the United States and Canada have never faced a revolution and have never faced a civil war. So when you twist the words and inject those in for the purpose of manipulating the conversation, then immediately that's a red flag for me that goes up. I just, you know, to a certain extent, yeah, it's geekiness and it's pet peeve and, you know, maybe I shouldn't be so picky with the terminology. But on the other hand, terminology is important when we're communicating complex ideas to one another. If we can't get our language straight and actually say what we mean to say, then it's impossible to communicate complex information and complex ideas to each other, because we're thinking on different trains of different paths of thought. So these terminologies are important. Okay, so anyway, so then he says, and this is a quote from him, he says, "It's unclear how Continentals were authorized." Now, let me stop. The Continental was the fiat money that was issued by the temporary governments during the War of Independence. So the Continental script, or there's a variety of different, and he is right, some issues were made in coin using 10 coins and other things like this. So there's some elements of truth to what he's saying. But then he says this, and this is the quote, he says, "It's unclear how Continentals were authorized. These fiat dollars made of paper and tin were used and accepted throughout the Revolutionary War period. They later became as worthless as a Continental as our new country labored under the Articles of Confederation." Now, there's a lot wrong with that. That's an actual quote. That's his words. Let me read it one more time. "It's unclear how Continentals were authorized. These fiat dollars made of paper and tin were used and accepted throughout the Revolutionary War period. They later became as worthless as a Continental as our new country labored under the Articles of Confederation." Well, let me just explain this to you, buddy. It's unclear how Continentals were authorized. They were authorized. They were just printed. The individual, at that time, still considered colonies or considering themselves states, the individual states printed their own just like they always had. And the but the Continental Congress would issue fiat money at times. And the reason they did this, because they were in the middle of the war and they didn't have a way to fund it. So they funded it through fiat money, and there was horrible inflation because of it. This is why it was so difficult for Washington to outfit his troops, because the Continental Congress kept issuing more and more fiat money to him, and the more they issued, the less it was worth, and nobody would take this nonsense. That's why he had soldiers with no shoes. So this is not a great mystery. It's unclear how Continentals were authorized. No, it's not. That's a lie. Again, you know, Rothbard has a wonderful history of this time frame. There's a 4-volume set called Conceived in Liberty, and all you have to do is go over to Mises.com and pick it up. And if you don't want to spend the money to buy it, you can download it in PDF form, or you can get it in audio version with the wonderful voice of Floyd Lilly reading it for you. This is not a great mystery on how this stuff took place. Rothbard goes through it all and documents every bit of it, and if there's any question about anything, it's one of the most documented works out there, and you can go through and find out everything where he gets all of his references from that. I'm going to have to speed up a little bit here, or else I'm going to run out of time before I get to my real points on this. Okay, so he says it's unclear how they were authorized. No, that's a lie. The fiat dollars were made of paper and tin. That's true. And they were accepted throughout the Revolutionary War period. Well, they were accepted at the point of a bayonet. Okay, they later became as worthless as a Continental as our new country labored under the Articles of Confederation. Well, they became as worthless as a Continental. They were a Continental, and the phrase "as worthless as a Continental" came into effect because they were fiat, backed by nothing. The only thing they had was faith, and when enough of them were printed, people lost faith in them, and they were worth nothing, like all fiat money does. Now, to blame this on the Articles of Confederation is a little bit unfair, but it's typical that these people who worship the Constitution would take any opportunity to bash the Articles of Confederation. Then he praises the Constitution and further pushes, I'm reading off my notes here. He praises the Constitution and further pushes the myth that it solved the crisis. Without getting into a whole Hamilton thing, all he's really doing is repeating the same nonsense that these guys always repeat at this point in time. Okay, so he says, and this is a quote, the Congress, oh no, I'm sorry, he's reading the Constitution here. He quotes the Constitution, and this is a quote from the Constitution. The Congress shall have the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. Now, here's the problem with this. The Greenbackers always quote this part of the Constitution. Now, let me read it to you one more time. The Congress shall have the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. Is there a mention there of paper or of script? Because paper money and script, these are the references, these are the terminology used to describe the kind of fiat money they had in those days. They either referred to it as paper, or they referred to it as script, or some other thing like that. They did not refer to it as coinage. Even the cheap 10 continentals were not really ever considered true coinage. Although, you have to remember that 10 does have a value. 10 is a commodity. Here's the point. The Greenbackers will always try to say, well, greenback money is what's constitutional. That's a lie. The Constitution did not authorize fiat money. It says right there, Congress shall have the power to coin money. That's not paper. That's not fiat. And then it goes on to say, regulate the value thereof. We're talking about the weight and the size and what it's called and things like that. And then it says, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. Now, we wouldn't be talking about weights and measures in this same sentence if we're talking about fiat money. Now, would we? We're talking about weights and measures of actual money, of hard currency. Remember that phrase, cold, hard cash? Well, paper's not cold and paper's not hard, but gold and silver are both cold and hard and cash. Cash being a storage. Cash is a storage. You ever hear that with your computer? You need to clear your cache? Well, you don't. That's a storage. Gold and silver in real money is a storage of wealth. It's a store of wealth. Whereas paper is the fiat, is the belief, the faith that there's wealth. That's a completely different object, a completely different thought. Okay, now hold on. Let's get back to this before I run out of time. Now, here's a direct quote that he says at this point. This is right around the 24 minute. I'm sorry, I didn't go minute by minute like I did with the other Greenbacker movies, but somewhere around the 24 minute point, he says this phrase, and this is word for word. For most, and he's referring to this piece in the Constitution here when he says this, that part of the Constitution I just read several times. This is his words. For most, this only authorized Congress to create money. Now, that's a blatant lie. That is just a lie. There's no other way you can look at that. Let's read this again. The Congress shall have the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and a foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measure. Okay? Now, to assume that this, for his words, for most, this only authorized Congress to create money. Now, why would that be? This is not a historically supported accusation, and it's completely illogical. Let me give you an example. If I was to say to you, let's say I own a roller skating rink. There's not a whole lot of those left around here, but some of us older folks will remember roller skating rinks. Now, let's say I have a big floor out there for people to roller skate on, and I have a skate rental, and I have a snack bar, and I have all the things that go with a roller skating rink. And I put my sign out, open for business, and people show up. And they come into my building, and they pay me a certain amount of money. And when they pay me a certain amount of money, let's say my name is Bill, and I run my roller skating rink, And Tom comes up, and he's my very first customer. And he opens the door and steps in. I say, "Welcome, Tom. You're my very first customer to my roller skating rink. The entrance fee is $1. And so he whips out $1 and hands it to me. And I say, "Thank you, Tom. You are now authorized to use my roller skating rink." And he goes inside and starts skating. Nothing in that statement means that Tom's the only one that can use the roller skating rink. By me authorizing Tom to use my roller skating rink does not mean that Tom has the exclusive use of the roller skating rink. Now let's read this again from the Constitution. "The Congress shall have the power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures." Okay? Does it say Congress shall have the exclusive right to coin money? Does it say Congress shall possess the exclusive monopoly on the production of money? Does it say anything like that? It doesn't. It says Congress shall have the power to coin money. In other words, yes, Congress can coin money, but nothing in that statement excludes Bill or Tom or Jerry or Mississippi or Virginia or any one or any other entity from coining money. Nothing in that statement gives the exclusive ability to coin money to Congress. It just says, yeah, they can too. It's just like the one guy who enters the roller skating rink doesn't mean nobody else can enter the rink. And that's the thing that the greenbackers will always fall back to. Now, I mentioned libertarians a moment ago. Libertarians get confused by these greenbackers' arguments. And at one point in this greenbackers movie, he actually flips up on the screen a picture of a book by Tom DeLorenzo, Hamilton's Curse. Now, this is just blatant propaganda, because clearly he didn't read Tom's book. If he had read Tom's book, he wouldn't be, or else maybe he did, and he's still being deceptive on this. But I don't think so. I think most of these people are just confused. But he uses the image of Tom's book to sort of associate libertarianism with this greenbacker nonsense. Now, that's a fairly typical thing you'll see the greenbackers doing. They didn't always do that. But of late, since about 2006 or so, when libertarianism started to really become popular and a lot of people started rushing into libertarianism, a lot of new people became libertarians that had never been in that camp before. And it was really the greenbackers found it really easy to con these people. All you have to do is mention Mises, maybe mention Rothbard, show a couple of images of a couple books, or show a tiny little piece of a Peter Schiff clip. And the libertarians say, oh, that's us. That's our camp. And they rush right in rather than stopping to really learn these things and find out about them. That's why the Greenbacker movement has grown so much recently, is because so many libertarians have been deceived into thinking that this is somehow a libertarian process. It's not. This is socialism. The very basis of the greenback idea is the control of the monetary supply, which is the means of production, by the government. If the government controls the means of production, you have socialism. That's the definition of socialism. That socialism is the opposite of libertarianism. These two things can't coexist. This is what Mises spent his life saying. And you don't have to be a consistent Austrian economist to be a libertarian. But the more consistently you understand the libertarian processes, the more consistently you understand that the economic explanation for libertarianism is the Austrian economics. You don't have to know everything about Austrian economics to be a libertarian. But as you examine the economic foundation of libertarianism, it is Austrian economics. And if you examine Austrian economics, the moral foundation of Austrian economics is libertarianism. Okay, let me try to move on here. I had to pause there just to get caught back up with my notes because I was starting to rant. I'm running out of time and I'm getting desperate to get to the end of all this because I really want to get it all in there. Okay, so he uses this stupid film clip out of some HBO movie or whatever. I'm not sure what it, I can't remember what it is. I tried to watch part of it, but it was pretty stupid, so I stopped. Anyway, and then he does a typical Greenbacker stunt by piggybacking. That's when he throws up Tom DiLorenzo's book, Hamilton's Curse, and doesn't actually refer to the book or quote out of it or anything like that. He just throws up the imagery, therefore piggybacking onto libertarians to get his own legitimacy from it. Okay, now, and here we go. Here's a timestamp. At 30 minutes, 32 seconds in, bingo, he says, he quotes, in his words, researcher Bill Still. Now, whenever you hear someone refer to researcher Bill Still, that's the right at that point, right? Okay, let's look at it this way. It used to be pirates back in the olden days, you know, in the Pirates of the Caribbean days. A pirate ship, it was hard to tell what was a merchant and what merchant was from what country and what was a pirate and anything else. So a pirate ship would often fly, let's say, a Dutch flag or an English flag or a French flag in order to lure another ship to put up a Dutch or an English flag or whatever. And this is a common trick that the privateers would do as well. And so the pirates would be waving, let's say, a Dutch flag, and so the merchant would put up a Dutch flag, and then the pirate would throw up an English flag or a French flag or whatever, and then rush in and attack it, all right? And you wouldn't really know what the pirate was until eventually he put up his pirate flag, and it was like, aha! But now it's too late, because now he's right on us, and he's got his guns trained on us, and we have to surrender. Well, that's kind of what happens when they throw up the Bill Still quote. You know, right there, the Greenbackers have put up their Greenback flag, and we can identify them now. And I've run out of time on this, but I do want to point out that at the 31 minute 36, there's more lies about private banking issuing certificates. Let's see. Okay, so there's lies at 31:36, and I've got written down here, massive lie, wild accusation that he's talking about the war between the states and how it's caused by the evil European bankers, and he pretends to quote Bismarck, but he doesn't actually quote Bismarck. He entirely fakes the quote, but he makes it sound like he's quoting Bismarck, and then he goes into the Lincoln worship. Now you've got him. Once he starts the Lincoln worship, you know you've got a Greenbacker. He says many of the notes printed remained, he's talking about the Greenbacker notes that Lincoln put out. He says many of the notes printed remained in circulation for another 130 years. Really? Lincoln Greenbacks remained in circulation till 1995? In what kind of twisted world did that take place? There were no 1860s greenback money floating around as currency in 1995. That is a blatant lie. And then at 33 minutes, 35 seconds, he refers to a noted UFO researcher as being a person he can refer to as evidence to support his argument. Now, keep in mind, the greenback money that was issued by Lincoln suffered a 48% per year inflation, and that's fairly conservative estimates. 48% inflation. You really want that? That sounds good? That's your best example of what the greenback can do, 48% inflation? I had to stop at that point. I just couldn't go any further. But I'm going to have to cut this off now. I don't know how much I'll have to even cut down to make it fit into time frames, but think of it this way. Here's something that the Greenbackers regularly do. It's kind of like this. It's kind of like a person comes to your house and says, you have termites. And in this case, it's the Federal Reserve is evil. Okay, you have termites. Here's the evidence. Damaged wood, termite trails, visible termite activity, etc. Okay, so with the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is evil. We have fractional reserve banking. We have out-of-control spending. We have loaning money into existence. We have all this fraud involved. So the Federal Reserve is evil. Okay, so we agree. You have termites. Okay? Therefore, because you have termites, we need to shoot your dog. Wait, what? What's my dog have to do with the termites? Now, that's the case with the Greenbackers. They want to make the argument that the Federal Reserve is bad. Yes, we all agree. And then they give all this evidence. The Federal Reserve is bad. We agree to that. And then they say, therefore, you have to have Congress issuing money. There's nothing logically to connect these two thoughts. nothing. Why should we abandon fascism to embrace socialism? It's just not necessary, and it's not a logical course. The market can determine what money is, what the value of money is, and what quantity of money needs to be circulated. The market can do that. That's called free market. That's what libertarianism is. Folks, for more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to badquaker.com. Thank you very much for listening.